23. Filming, flying, crashing, burning. "Ron, here's the way it works at New World Pictures," Roger Corman said to me a few days before we began shooting. "I'm going to come to the set the first day and maybe the second day. If things are going well, you won't see very much of me after that. But if things are not going well, you're going to see one hell of a lot of me." As ominous as this declaration sounded, Roger had taken care to surround me with his finest Cormanites. My second unit director was Alan Arkish, a still young but already seasoned guy who, with his friend Joe Dante, had directed a $60,000 kitsch comedy classic for Roger called Hollywood Boulevard that repurposed footage from other New World movies. Dante was tapped to serve as Grand Theft Auto's editor. Joe, you probably know, went on to direct the Gremlins franchise, while Alan's next step was to make the Ramones movie Rock and Roll High School for New World. He is now a major TV producer-director. Our cinematographer was a fascinating, intellectually astute man named Gary Graver. Gary had been a combat photographer in Vietnam and had worked with Orson Welles on his later films, F for Fake and The Other Side of the Wind. He also had a thriving career, under a pseudonym, as a director of porno films. I did a ton of prep work to make sure I was worthy of this crew and because I didn't want to blow this chance. A couple of months before we started shooting, Roger ordered me to compose a complete shot list for the movie, instilling a habit that I retain to this day. I was no good at storyboarding because I can't draw, but he told me that I also needed to diagram the car chases on paper. "How do I do that, Roger?" I asked. "Treat the cars like characters," he said. "They're characters in conflict, just like actors." It was great advice that I put to use again nearly four decades later when I made Rush, my film about the Formula One racers Niki Lauda and James Hunt. I was finishing up the fourth season of Happy Days while doing all this prep. One day, on the Paramount lot, I was intercepted by Jonathan Demme, who had just graduated from the Corman School to making his first studio picture, Handle with Care, a CB radio comedy starring my American Graffiti castmates, Paul LaMatte and Candy Clark. Demme, dressed like a 1950s private eye on vacation, straw Panama hat, Hawaiian shirt, and two-tone spectator shoes. "I hear you're doing a movie for Roger," he said. "Let me give you a few tips." In the most gracious way, Jonathan reminded me that a Corman movie is supposed to be fun. Find the fun and don't get caught up in logic or technique. It was a nice way of saying, don't be pretentious. Another big tip was make your days, meaning complete a minimum of 20 camera setups a day. By setup, I mean the positioning of the camera, the lights, and the actors, followed by the execution of the shot. Setups vary in their complexity depending on the demands of the scene, the number of actors, and the angles involved. A formulaic TV drama can hack its way along at a rapid clip, but most of the studio pictures I had worked on to that date completed about 8 to 10 setups a day. A Corman film required twice that pace. That's common now in the digital age, but it was crazy rapid for the mid-70s. Demme's last tip was get your sleep. Fat chance on that one. My days were already jam-packed. Wake up, work on the shot list and diagram, go to work at Happy Days, zoom to the production office to meet with Dad and Alan. I got the one and only speeding ticket of my life while busting ass to get from Happy Days to a Grand Theft Auto pre-production meeting. I was pulled over for passing someone on the right. I should have written off the ticket as research for my part. Dad was obsessed with making sure that Sam and Paula's route from L.A. to Vegas was visually and geographically correct. He had roadmaps spread out all over the office, trying to figure out locations true to the scenes in our script, a dirt road, a two-lane highway, a street with potholes. He talked me into taking a scouting trip along the screenplay's route. We went in two cars, and a good thing we did. At one point, my Volvo wagon got stuck in some soft, silty sand in the desert. We had to use Dad's Ford Bronco to push my car bumper to bumper out of its potential automobile grave. It would have made a hell of a Bronco commercial. True to his word, Roger showed up on our first shooting day. As ever, he wore a attire more befitting a Stanford-educated industrial engineer, which he actually was, than a producer of car crash flicks, smart chinos, loafers, and a button-down shirt. We had rented a house in Beverly Hills to stand in for the home of Paula and her family, from whom she escapes with the Rolls-Royce, setting the plot in motion. I cast Nancy Morgan, soon to marry John Ritter, as Paula. We had gotten our hands on a two-tone, golden-black 1959 Silver Cloud for her to drive. We could only afford to rent it on the days when we needed simple wide shots of Paula driving uneventfully. For chases and stunts, we used a series of clapped-out old Bentleys, which had a body shape similar to the Silver Cloud, and disguised them as rollers by attaching a grill and a winged woman ornament to their hoods. I still have that ornament. It's all that survived of the Bentleys we totaled. I needed to get 27 setups done that first day. By the time we broke for lunch, I had completed 6. My first morning as a director was a disaster. As we shot the interior scenes, the ones in which Paula argues with her parents, I methodically tried to get the staging and performances correct. But I was working at a snail's pace. No way was I going to get a further 21 shots done that day. Roger had spent the morning parked in a chair next to the camera, watching the proceedings without expression or comment. I was convinced that he would fire me at day's end, a lifetime of yearning swirling down the drain. My stomach knotted up as I headed to my dressing room, unable to eat. Then Gary Graver knocked on my door. I imagine that either the production manager or Roger himself had sent him in to buck me up. Very calmly, Gary helped me plot out the rest of the day, simplifying the remaining setup so that we could go faster. After lunch, we powered through and miraculously caught up. "Make your days," Jonathan Demme had said. We did. Gary and the crew had rescued me. What I learned in that single afternoon, and would come to understand even better as the shoot went on, was that a director needs to communicate and ask for help. The crew can set up the next few scenes while you're focused on the one you're shooting. The cinematographer and assistant directors can advise you on efficient ways to achieve your creative ambitions with little compromise. The director can humbly defer to the opinions of others and actually increase rather than diminish the respect he commands on set. Roger was beaming at day's end. He shook my hand and didn't even show up for day 2. I have never felt more physically tired than I did at the end of that first day. The combination of acting, directing, and carrying the burden of being in charge of everything had utterly depleted me. My feet hurt, my back was sore, and my hair was matted with sweat. But you know what? I couldn't wait to wake up the following day and do it all over again. As the shoot went on, I discovered that the less I was in the movie, the more I enjoyed directing. A crucial distinction that would soon come to bear on my acting career. I really got a kick out of directing the Grand Theft Auto cast. There was a warm, loving, old home week vibe to the proceedings because so many of the players came from different parts of my life. Dad, Clint, and Pete, Marion, Gary, Jim Ritz. Dad and I created a part especially for Ho Cal, his pal and frequent writing partner, as a sleazy preacher who steals a police car to pursue the young lovers and get the $25,000 reward. Hoke, a native of South Carolina, was in his element, gleefully chewing the scenery like it was pulled pork. As it happens, food became a major issue during the shoot, the subject of my first managerial crisis. By our 8th day, the crew was in open revolt about the quality of the grub they were being served. Our production was feeding them a steady diet of McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken, unlike the old-timers on The Andy Griffith Show, who were all too happy to subsist on cigarettes, stale coffee, and donuts. My young crew actually cared about its health and well-being. The unyielding onslaught of greasy fast food was bringing down morale, something that Cheryl, more than anyone else, had picked up on. She went to our line producer, a man named John Davison, and asked him what the daily budget was for catering. The number she got was $2 per person. "Ron," she told me, "for that amount, I can feed everyone a whole lot better than what we're settling for." At that point, we had finished shooting our LA scenes, and we were about to head out to the hinterlands of Victorville, California, on the edge of the Mojave Desert, where the majority of our smash and crash action sequences would be filmed. It so happened that Cheryl's maternal grandparents, Les and Lillian Schmid, owned a one-room cinder block vacation cabin, so Spartan that its bathroom was an outhouse, in the same area. Cheryl got their permission to use the house's kitchenette and began to compose a menu with my blessing. Mom was worried about this scheme and made her feelings known. "Cheryl, men and their stomachs are monsters," she said. "You are setting yourself up for a disaster. For the love of God, don't do it." But Cheryl was determined. She went food shopping with her grandparents and set to work in their little kitchen. Our first day in the desert was cold and windy with gray skies. Yet all workplace discontent evaporated when shortly before lunchtime, our maroon Volvo wagon appeared from over the horizon with 23-year-old Cheryl at the wheel. She had prepared a lunch of rack of lamb, roasted vegetables, and a fresh green salad. The members of our crew were beside themselves with gratitude. Mom dove in to help bring service with a smile to the catering line. She happily conceded that she was wrong to have doubted her daughter-in-law. Alan Arkish and Joe Dante still talk about how Cheryl saved my ass by feeding the crew properly. But I was so caught up in every last detail of the film that I was not sufficiently partaking of the quality catering. Grand Theft Auto had only 23 shooting days, with Sundays off. Yet in that short span, I was wasting away. I began the shoot at 150 pounds, which suited my 5'9 frame. A few weeks later, Joe, concerned for my well-being, confronted me about my gaunt appearance and urged me to take better care of myself. When I got on a scale, I discovered that my weight was down to 136 pounds. Yikes. Roger returned for a visit when I was working on the last big set piece for the film, in which nearly every car in the movie gets totaled in a demolition derby. Between the Malachi brothers and Grand Theft Auto, I was the face of the mid-70s demolition zeitgeist. We were shooting at Saugus Speedway, a stock car racetrack and former rodeo arena in Santa Clarita, a half an hour north of Burbank. Roger arrived with a separate filmmaking crew in tow. He was the subject of a documentary in progress and was being followed around by a camera. He was in good spirits and was pleased with how Grand Theft Auto was going. I tried to leverage this into a request. The demolition derby was supposed to end in a riot, with people jumping out of the stands and running onto the midway. We had only been budgeted to hire 50 extras for this scene, which struck me as stingy. I wanted to at least create the illusion of thousands of people wreaking havoc and causing chaos. Nowadays, my team can accomplish this by using digital extras, but that wasn't an option on the table then. Besides, on such films as Far and Away, Cinderella Man, Backdraft, and Rush, I've used anywhere from 500 to 2,000 extras on certain days. Roger, we're coming in on schedule and under budget, so I was wondering if we could hire 100 extras instead of 50, I said. I can do a much better shot where I pan across the crowd and make it seem like it's huge. He was unmoved. Why don't you just do a cut of the 50 people getting up, he said. They all run in at once and you have what you need. Well, yeah, but I could do something much more fluid and believable with more extras, I said. Even if I had 75, I could have them sit in the stands in a pie wedge shape and frame the shot so there's a bigger sense of scope and scale. Roger clapped a hand on my shoulder and smiled. Ron, let me tell you something. You finish up this picture and do a good job with it, and you'll never have to work for me again, he said. But all you're getting from me is 50 extras. Make it work. And so I did, more or less. I framed a series of tight shots of my crowd and explained away the vast tracts of empty seats in my wide shots by having the Speedway's PA announcer say, "Due to the extreme danger of this event, remain clear of the north section of the bleachers." The Derby sequence took 2 days to shoot. Alan Arkish and I apparently combined to hold what was, for a time, the Guinness World Record for the greatest number of camera setups ever executed in a single day, 81. That's a dubious distinction, though I must sheepishly admit that I have since exceeded that number, and I bet Alan has as well. As the sun went down on our last day of shooting, I still had to capture the scene of our fake Rolls-Royce getting wrecked at the Derby, and of Nancy and me gleefully fleeing the vehicle. The final setup had four cameras covering our sprint and a slow-motion shot of the iconic Rolls-Royce grille falling off the ruined car. Frustratingly, the timing of the grille fall was off and needed to be reshot. Using just one camera, Gary Graver and I oversaw a retake in which a rival car bumped the Rolls' grille, and our effects team perfectly timed their yank on the hidden wire rig. The grill bounced to the ground in slow motion, twisting in the air like the stricken gunfighters whose balletic deaths I had so admired in The Wild Bunch. If you're going to steal, steal from the best. Once we had that shot, we followed the usual protocol, in which the camera assistant checks the camera's gate to make sure it hasn't been compromised by hair or dirt. After a beat, the assistant shouted, "The gate is good." At that, the entire production team cast its eyes toward me. I had the presence of mind to savor the moment before I called out the words I had been waiting the better part of my life to say. "That's a wrap." A cheer went up and my shoulders went down, relaxed for the first time in weeks. That night we had a spontaneous wrap party at a dive bar nearby. There was a band playing rockabilly music, and we were all doing flamers, shots of vodka that you light on fire and then tip back into your mouth while they're still burning, to celebrate. I held Cheryl tight on the dance floor, my head slightly buzzed and my lips slightly singed. I looked over her shoulder and saw Mom, Dad, and Clint with huge smiles on their faces. I saw the members of the cast and crew clinking glasses. As an actor, I had known what it was like to wrap a project, breathing a sigh of relief after weeks of spikes and plummets in confidence. No matter how rocky the ride, the job was done. As a director, it felt different. Every day from dawn to dusk, I had been compelled to make what seemed like thousands of decisions. Thousands more awaited in post-production. The sheer breadth of my responsibilities was daunting and occasionally terrifying. But now I also knew the satisfaction of being at the center of things, charged with rallying the troops, winning their trust, and solving our collective problems. When the solutions revealed themselves in one little eureka moment after another, I felt a high I had never known before. I whispered to Cheryl, "I love directing even more than I thought I would." This remains one of the top three moments of my life connected to a film. The only other two that compare are when I screened Apollo 13 for the NASA people in Houston and received their enthusiastic blessing, and when I won Best Director and Best Picture at the Academy Awards for A Beautiful Mind. Like Clint says, no filmmaker ever sets out to make a B picture. In my mind, when we began shooting Grand Theft Auto, I thought we were making a movie that might rival the recent work of Robert Altman and Hal Ashby. I knew that we stood no chance with the Motion Picture Academy during awards season, but the Golden Globes had a comedy category and our script was funny. If I brought my A game and really executed, hell, why not us? This cockeyed optimism vanished, along with my rap night euphoria, when we put together our first cut of the movie. Joe did a great job, and Alan and Dad were pleased with how well the comedy played. But once I watched it through, it hit me. This ain't no Golden Globes-worthy movie. This is a Roger Corman movie. On the sidewalk outside the editing facility on McCadden Place, in the heart of old Hollywood, I confided my disappointment to Dad. He did not share my dejected feelings. He told me that the film was exactly what it was supposed to be. He advised me to buck up and work with him, Joe, Alan, and John Davison on making Grand Theft Auto the best fucking Roger Corman movie it could possibly be. Which was something I needed to hear. Roger liked our cut, but he wanted to hold a test screening for it. He booked a place in L.A. that was better known for testing commercials and TV shows than feature-length films. We brought a black-and-white work print of our color film, with no music or sound effects added in yet, to the testing center. It was a place unlike any I had ever seen before, with each seat in the house equipped with a dial that the viewer could turn to the right when she experienced a moment she liked, and to the left when she saw something she didn't like. Then the test audience marched in. A parade of blue-haired old ladies, some of whom were probably born in the 1890s. What the hell? I turned to Roger and said, "This isn't the audience for Grand Theft Auto. They can't evaluate it." Roger merely shrugged. John Davison pulled me aside to explain. The testing center agreed to screen Roger's films for free as long as they could piggyback the screenings on tests for TV commercials. The day we were there, the center was screening ads for Geritol, the dietary supplement marketed to elderly people. I was mortified about my film's future and about offending these women with our movie's off-color humor. But damned if Roger didn't know exactly what he was doing. We were seated directly behind a few of the old ladies in the screening room. We saw and heard them guffaw at the movie's more raw gags, such as the moment where Marion Ross's character backhands Jim Ritz's policeman in the groin. I looked at Dad to my left and Cheryl to my right and stage whispered, "It's working." As soon as the movie was over and the house lights went on, one of these old ladies, who I distinctly saw laughing her head off, turned to her friend with a stern face and said, "Well, that was disgusting." The testing center provided us with printout graphs of the audience's reactions. They looked like sine waves, peaks for the fun parts, dips for the dull parts. Roger announced that we needed to cut every dip from the picture. Once again, I spiraled into despair. How will I even end up with a coherent film? Joe Dante talked me off that ledge, explaining that Roger's comments were general marching orders, not edicts to be followed to the letter. One last personal crisis reared its head when Roger decided that the movie wasn't quite zany enough to wow a New World Pictures audience. I was powerless to object to this, and, against my wishes, he had Alan direct two new action sequences. Through most of the movie, Sam and Paula are pursued not only by bounty hunters, but also by a ratings-hungry disc jockey named Curly Q Brown, who was played by a legendary L.A. DJ known as the Real Don Steele. Roger wanted Curly to receive a comeuppance, so he added a new scene in which the DJ decamps from his news helicopter and pursues the couple in a car, only to lose control of it, drive clear through a house, launch into the air, and crash into an above-ground swimming pool. The other addition was an embellishment of a brief chase scene in which two hillbillies throw sticks of dynamite at Sam and Paula's car. Roger and Alan expanded that moment into a rootin' tootin' farcical routine in which the hillbillies start heaving the sticks willy-nilly, including at a roadside fruit stand, resulting in a multicolored melon explosion. I hated this idea with a passion. The chase and explosion scenes that Dad and I had written were grounded in some version of reality. This was Wile E. Coyote shit. I was so upset that I briefly considered taking my name off the movie and threatening not to promote it. Fortunately, cooler heads, mainly those of Dad, Alan, John Davison, and my new agent, Larry Bexy, prevailed. They explained to me that adding new scenes after principal photography had been completed is, in the movie business, normal. I've since done it many times. The 23-year-old redhead with the unearned auteur complex still had a lot to learn. But here's the thing. That redhead had succeeded in making a film. An honest-to-God, theatrically released film. His benefactor, Mr. Corman, was mighty pleased with it. A small premiere was held for Grand Theft Auto at an independent theater in Beverly Hills. The Happy Days people and the New World Pictures people all turned out in support, and the movie and its director were the beneficiaries of a ton of goodwill. The press lapped up the story. Richie Cunningham grows up to be a filmmaker. And everywhere I walked on the Paramount lot, I was heartily congratulated. We received remarkably positive reviews upon the movie's release on June 18, 1977. Though I consider the making of Grand Theft Auto to be one of the formative experiences of my adult life, I have to admit that I can't get through a viewing of the film. I see all the rookie mistakes and hear all the corny jokes, and I just have to shut it off. But in Roger Corman terms, the film was a success. It cost $602,000 to make and earned $6 million at the box office. In Ron Howard terms, it was a beginning. I knew I was still a babe in the woods, but now I had something to build on. Cheryl and I went to see the movie on the night of its release at one of the finer theaters it played at in the greater LA area, the Pickwick Drive-In in Burbank, where we had steamed up the windows of my VW Bug many a time back in our high school days. 5 long years later, we steamed them up once more, and I never did work for Roger again.
The funny thing is, I did. In fact, I've got a dozen Corman movies on my resume. About a year after Grand Theft Auto, I was cast in Rock and Roll High School, which Alan directed with Joe's help. I played Eagle Bauer, the slick, wide-lapelled, medallion-wearing fixer of Vince Lombardi High School. Operating out of a plush office located in a stall in the boys' bathroom, Eaglebauer did a bang-up trade in fake IDs, bootleg liquor, and the discreet arrangement of romantic assignations. If you set aside my appearance as Baylock in Star Trek, this marked the beginning in earnest of my career as a character actor. Towhead Clint had disappeared into a swirling vortex of adolescence and self-doubt, but out of that vortex shot character Clint, the versatile eccentric guy you could cast as a psycho in a horror movie, a comic supporting player in an Adam Sandler movie, or a flight controller in a Ron Howard movie. You name it, I'll give it a spin. A light bulb went on over my head when I saw Dennis Hopper's turn in Apocalypse Now. I so admired his performance. He was completely over the top, yet completely committed, so that you believed him within the context of his lunacy. I said to myself, I can do that. I still had a lot of personal issues to deal with before I found my groove, though. I lasted less than a semester at Pepperdine. NBC gave Ron and me the go-ahead to write a TV movie we had pitched called Cotton Candy, about a nerdy teen who starts a high school rock band. Charlie Martin Smith played the lead, and the film ended up being the second that Ron directed. To me, this break made me think I was wasting my time sitting through courses about Kierkegaard and comparative religion. Before I withdrew, though, I used the lawn of my dormitory as my screenwriting office, camping out in a folding chair with a notepad, with the Pacific in glorious view. When I needed a change of scenery, I drove down to Straw Hat Pizza in Malibu's commercial district, my riding efforts lubricated by a pitcher of beer. As beautiful as this setup was, I concluded I had better things to do in Burbank. I was already driving back there 3 or 4 times a week to see my drug buddies and fortify my stash. So I disenrolled, thinking no further down the line than cotton candy and the paycheck it promised. I'm not sure I would have necessarily benefited from a college education, but I regret that I never gave college a fair shake. By the way, cotton candy was my first and last major screenwriting credit to date. I did myself no favors by entering adulthood free of the regimented structure of school or series television. By the 1980s, my boozing and using were no longer the merry, consequence-free habits I had perceived them to be as a teenager. I wasn't content to merely snort cocaine, for example. Most people had never heard the word freebasing until Richard Pryor burned his face trying to smoke vaporized coke in 1980. But when I heard about his accident, I thought, yeah, I know exactly how that happened. I spent the 80s skidding along bedrock. In one particularly terrible bout of drug-induced paranoia, I pieced together some facts that, to me, irrefutably proved I was the Antichrist. 1, I shared a birthday with Adolf Hitler. 2, when I was 10, I played a boy who predicted the end of the world in the anthology TV series Night Gallery. And 3, when I was 20, I played an outcast cadet at a military academy who becomes possessed by Satan and murders his tormentors in the horror movie Evil Speak. There was a period when I didn't even have keys to Mom and Dad's house in Toluca Lake, my childhood home, because they couldn't trust me in my behavioral compromised state. I can't blame them. I scared the hell out of myself. I also scared the hell out of my neighbors. One day in 1988, I was so wigged out on speed and liquor that I literally tried to jump out of my body, my very being. In doing so, I jumped over a property wall and into the yard next door, where my unglued presence terrified the guests at what had been a sedate, pleasant gathering. They called the cops on me.
I sensed something amiss with Clint as the 1970s turned into the 1980s. He had taken to arriving late for events and appointments, not his normal style. When he did this on Dad's birthday, his voice ragged and his eyes puffy as he finally joined us for a celebratory dinner at the smokehouse, I could no longer rationalize his drug use as recreational. I had by then witnessed enough behind the scenes in show business to know that Clint couldn't keep living the way he was if he wanted to survive into the next century. I confronted him with my concerns in 1980 when we went together to Super Bowl XIV, which was played between the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Los Angeles Rams at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena. "It's one thing to use drugs, and another thing to let drugs use you," I told him.
Ron gave me a kind-hearted big brother talk. He does those well. He always begins with the words, "Now I'm going to give you some unsolicited advice." Over the years, I have sometimes gotten irritated when Ron uttered those words. Oh, geez, here it comes again, the talk. But I've always also appreciated his efforts and loved him for trying. He's never approached things subliminally. He's never tried to couch what he was doing in some sort of BS parable or metaphor. He addresses the subject straight on. I politely received Ron's admonition, but I was at the Super Bowl for crying out loud. Not on a psychiatrist's couch. I told Ron he had made some good points, but I wasn't ready to act on them. I was still having too good a time and had no idea how worried my family was.
Clint's behavior weighed heavily on my mind during one of my last acting jobs in a 1980 TV film called Act of Love. Mickey Rourke and I played brothers. In the movie, his character had been rendered quadriplegic by a motorcycle accident. He begs his younger brother, my character, to end his life. The younger brother heeds the older's wishes. Then he has to stand trial for his actions. I had an emotional monologue to perform on the witness stand, explaining how much I loved my brother, how much he meant to me, Truth be told, it had been years since I had gone to a deep emotional place in a scene. Somewhere in my adolescence, I had closed off my access to raw feelings. I resorted to fake tears and ammonia capsules, show business crutches that were supposed to be an anathema to us Howards. But on the day we shot the courtroom scene, I began to connect the speech I had memorized with my worries about Clint, my barely acknowledged fear that I could possibly lose him to addiction. In the wide master shot, I could feel my face flushing hot with emotion. The director, Judd Taylor, was sensitive to actors. He whispered in my ear that I should go somewhere quiet and hang on to whatever I was working with. Within minutes, the crew had hustled the camera into position for my close-up. When Judd quietly called action, I let images of Clint, loaded and straight, flood my mind as I spoke. I was no longer recalling Gulliver the dog's death. I was connecting to my mature fears about my vulnerable little brother and what he was going through. That's the take the director used. It's the last time that I wept real tears on screen.
I tried to get sober a few times, the first in 1984, of my own initiative. I opened up the Yellow Pages and found a listing for Beverly Glen Hospital, which offered a 28-day inpatient program for treating drug and alcohol dependency. Little did I know how fortunate I was to happen on this, of all places. A mere 2 years earlier, Beverly Glen had hosted the very first meetings of Cocaine Anonymous. It was ground zero for what is now a worldwide organization. Mom and Dad did their best to help me. Throughout my dark decade, they were the one consistent positive in my life. They went to meetings of Al-Anon and Nar-Anon, fellowship programs for the loved ones of people experiencing addiction. These are distinct from Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, which are 12-step programs for addicts pursuing recovery. That first time I went into treatment, Dad, in solidarity, quit drinking too. He never took another drop. Like a normie, which is what we in the recovery community call those who aren't afflicted by addiction, he remarked to me that he didn't miss it at all. For Mom, my troubles were especially hard to bear because she viewed my problems as an inheritance from her side of the family. But that didn't make anything her fault. Like a lot of addicts, I needed a few tries before recovery took. Ron, bless him, consistently cast me in his movies throughout my using years. I prided myself on delivering for him and carrying myself with the utmost professionalism on his sets. In 1990, though, when we were making Backdraft, his movie about professional firefighters, he made a strange request of me. I played an autopsy technician in the film and had a scene to do with Robert De Niro, who played a Chicago Fire Department captain. De Niro, Kurt Russell, and Billy Baldwin researched their roles by shadowing real firefighters. Ron suggested that I do the same in my character's field. So I went to the LA County Morgue to observe the professionals there. I saw victims of overdoses, drug-related murders, and drunk drivers. Nearly every cold body laying out before me on a slab represented a life cut short, directly or indirectly, by drink or drugs. That was a huge wake-up call. On June 14, 1991, I cried uncle. I was no longer deriving any joy from drinking or taking drugs, though Lord knows I kept trying to the bitter end. This time there was no expensive treatment program, no getaway to a gated rehab center. I found a home group, the AA term for a meeting one attends on a regular basis, and a sponsor. One day at a time, my life started to improve. Dad really stepped up for me in this shaky period of recovery. Ron and Cheryl had moved to the East Coast in 1985 after their twins Paige and Jocelyn were born and were understandably busy raising small kids. In his firm but loving way, Dad helped me along my path without any of the hair-trigger anger he displayed the day that I thrust my bong in his face. He and Mom laid down firm guidelines for me as I rebuilt my life. Gradually, I regained their trust and my own sense of self-worth. I reconnected with the Clint who didn't need a drink, a toke, or a toot to get through the day. I'm happy with my lot as a character actor and my place in the industry. It isn't the exalted place where Ron lives, but it suits me just fine. I'm more like Dad, a working actor who waits for the phone to ring. Sometimes there are moments of profound frustration, but hey, that's the life that I signed up for. The pisser about being an actor is that you can't make anyone hire you. All you can do is suit up, apply what you know, and do the best you can. My phone has never rung off the hook, but it has rung enough to keep me going. I have well over 200 TV and movie credits to my name. Some of these are horror picks you've never heard of unless you're a dedicated consumer of the genre. Lots of my jobs have paid me no more than scale, or just a hair above. You know what? I'm damn proud of them all. How many people have sustained an acting career from their toddler years to their 60s? It's fair to say that I've entertained literally millions of people over the years, in movies ranging from Rock and Roll High School, to Evil Speak, to Austin Powers, to The Waterboy. That, along with still being alive, and still working, is a testament to my resilience and the support and guidance I was privileged to receive from Rance and Gene Howard. Oh, and being Ron's brother is pretty cool, too.